senior IRGC commander, warned that if Israel takes any action against Iranian nuclear sites, the regime will face a more powerful response in kind. Iran rejects Israel's allegation about damaging the Dimona nuclear plant during its recent punitive operation, calling it part of the regime's psychological warfare. The Iranian foreign minister says Tehran will make Israel regret any new attack on the country after Iran's punitive operation against the regime. Thank you for joining us. Iran has warned that in case of an Israeli military attack on the country's nuclear facilities, it will give a response in kind to the regime's aggression. Ahmad Haqtalab is the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unit, which is responsible for safeguarding Iran's nuclear sites. He said Iran has identified all Israeli nuclear sites and powerful Iranian missiles are ready to destroy specified targets at any moment. Haqtalab added that Iran might reconsider its nuclear doctrine and policies in case of any Israeli aggression against its nuclear facilities. He said Iran has always had the power to attack the regime's nuclear bases, but has remained committed to international regulations that prohibit such attacks. Haqtalab stressed, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution has said before, the days of hit and run are over for Israel. He noted that in case of an Israeli attack on Iran, the country's response will be powerful and destructive. Now here's a number of the more known Israeli military sites that could be possible targets for the Iranian armed forces in case Israel further escalates the tension.
Negev Nuclear Research Center, Dimona. The Shimon Peres Negev Nuclear Research Center is an Israeli nuclear installation located in the Negev Desert, about 13 kilometers southeast of the city of Dimona. Israel's plutonium production and extraction facilities, along with other weapons-related infrastructure, are situated there. Ilaban is Israel's second weapons storage facility. Tactical nuclear shells and landmines are among its contents. Kfar Zecharia, Israel's suspected nuclear missile base and bomb storage facility. Nahal Sorek. This one is the equivalent of the U.S. National Weapons Laboratories. The lab handles weapons design and construction, as well as research. Yodefat is a suspected nuclear weapons assembly facility. Tirosh, reportedly one of two Israeli nuclear weapons storage facilities. It is speculated that Tirosh is a strategic weapons storage site, while Ilaban is a tactical weapons storage site. Rafael Factory. Rafael has been responsible for the assembly of Israel's missiles.
The spokesman for Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has rejected Israel's allegation about damage to the Dimona nuclear plant during Iran's recent punitive operation. Brigadier General Ramadan Sharif says the claim is part of the regime's psychological warfare. Sharif added that the Dimona power plant was not amongst targets of Iran's retaliatory operation. He said the regime's allegation was nothing but a big lie, which is aimed at deceiving the public opinion. His remarks came after Israeli media claimed that at least one missile has hit a building in the Dimona plant during the Iranian operation. The regime has threatened to give a response to Iran's retaliatory operation, which hit its military bases. Iran has vowed to respond in kind to any Israeli attack on its nuclear sites. explosions have been heard near Iran's central city of Isfahan, but the reasons are still unclear. For now, outgoing flights at a number of airports have been cancelled, and also air defences were activated in a number of Iranian provinces. Iranian media says that it shot a few quadcopters around Isfahan. Now, earlier we discussed this issue with former CIA analyst Larry Johnson. He said if the Israelis were truthful about Iran's attack on their nuclear site, they would have already released footage of the damage.
Israel needs to figure out its story. I mean, first we were told they shot all the missiles down. They shot them all to 99.9%. I understand one got through and hit the Dimona nuclear facility. So, which is... Now, the one thing that is absent in all of the Israeli both accusations and claims is that if that facility had actually been hit, why didn't Israel take a press crew there with film to film it? And if Israel tries to retaliate, especially if it retaliates hitting a target inside Iran, that Iran is more than capable of sending back an even larger attack than what Israel experienced on the 14th. So there's that as a concern, coupled with Iran's ability to shut down the Straits of Hormuz. You know, we've already seen sort of a preview of this with the Houthis in the Red Sea. Here the United States has had its one of its most powerful carrier task force on scene, bombing the Houthis relentlessly, and it hasn't been able to open up the Red Sea passage.
This is why Iran has warned that it will make Israel regret any new attack on its soil following the country's punitive operation against the regime. We discussed Iran's retaliatory operation and Israel's subsequent threats with our guests in the News Review program. Let's take a listen. And now it's time for the News Review section, where we delve deeper into the day's one of the day's top stories. So stay tuned. Now, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has warned that Tehran will make Israel regret any new attack on the country after Iran's punitive operation against the regime.
Iran's legitimate defense and countermeasures have been concluded. Therefore, the Israeli regime, the terrorist Israeli regime, must be compelled to stop any further military adventurism against our interests. Certainly, in case of any use of force by the Israeli regime and of violating our sovereignty, the Islamic Republic of Iran will not hesitate a bit to assert its inherent right to give a decisive and proper response to it to make the regime regret its actions.
Amir Abdollahian was addressing a UN Security Council meeting on tensions in West Asia. He said Tehran's punitive attack on Israel was a minimal and limited operation in accordance with Iran's legitimate right to self-defense. He also slammed Western countries for their efforts to prevent the UN Security Council from condemning Israel's attack on Iran's embassy in Damascus. Iran's top diplomat underlined Tehran's prominent role in securing stability in the region, saying Iran will continue its efforts in this regard. As for the situation in Gaza, Amir Abdollahian called on the UN Security Council to bring Israel and its allies to justice for committing genocide in the besieged Palestinian territory. He said Israel is an occupying regime and the passage of time will not give it legitimacy. Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. William Jones, Washington Bureau Chief of Executive Intelligence Review from Washington, D.C., and also Mr. Jim Kavanaugh, political analyst and blogger from New York. Gentlemen, welcome to the News Review section. Now, Mr. Jones, beginning with you, first of all, let's begin with your thoughts on what happened on April 14th and Iran's response to the Israeli attack on its Damascus embassy 2 weeks prior.
Well, obviously, it was a major move on the part of Iran, which was only fended off largely because the entire U.S. military and their so-called allies were at work to try and prevent any major damage. They're saying that there was no damage at all, but obviously there were rockets that did hit effectively, but nobody is really telling us, what they achieved. There's a total control of the media in that respect over here. But it was the legitimate right of Iran to respond to what was a violation of international law, generally understood by most countries as a violation and attacks on a sovereign embassy. And it was moderate. It could have been worse. The Israelis, because they had the protection of the United States, were able to fend off much of that, and Iran made very clear that they were not going to do any more after this rather massive assault. The Israelis, however, are still threatening now to do something. They're maybe being limited by the U.S. president, which is afraid of a major war in the Middle East that could be triggered by further Israeli action. But I'm not sure how far he has gone and how much the Israelis are going to listen to him. But I think that what did happen, of course, was a legitimate response to a violation of international law by Israel, not to speak of the genocide that's going on in Gaza.
That's right. Mr. Kavanaugh, nice seeing you again. Mr. Kavanaugh, Iran has warned time and again that it will make Israel regret any new attack on the country with a bigger and broader response. Now, do you think the Israeli regime has learned its lesson that Iran is not messing around and is not just empty promises? And your thoughts on Iran's reprisal attack, has it in any way forced the regime to rethink how they approach Iran from now on?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all.
You're welcome.
You know, Iran's attack, as the previous guest said, was carefully coordinated in a way that was demonstrating the intent not to escalate. Iran cooperated with the United States and with the countries of the region by announcing it in advance, allowing Israelis to take critical assets and personnel out of the way. But Iran still demonstrated that it can hit its targets. Apparently 5 of 7 missiles hit the Nevatim Air Force Base, which is protected by the best air defenses in the world. So Israel has Iran demonstrated it can hurt Israel. I don't think Israel doubts that. I think they know Iran has the capability of doing a lot of damage to Israel. But Israel, unlike Iran, is not even cooperating with the United States. They're telling the United States, we want to escalate, we're going to escalate. They're not cooperating to prevent escalation. Now, what I just heard today is that the United States has said to Israel, well, okay, you can invade Rafah if you limit your attack on Iran. And what does that mean? I mean, the fact is, this is an extremely dangerous situation. Once Israel attacks Iran, and I'm convinced it will, the Israeli government, the leadership of the Zionist movement, they have wanted a war with Iran for 15 years. They've been trying to get the United States involved in it, and they will. If Israel attacks Iran, and Iran retaliates, and it will, the United States is going to get involved. It's a terrible situation. And, you know, this business with the Dimona power plant is very nasty, because what Israel is doing is introducing nuclear into the equation. And Israel is going to strike. Israel is not going to undertake, precisely because they know how strong Iran is. Israel is not going to undertake this action without using every weapon at its disposal, without trying to destroy the Iranian nuclear sites. And it's going to be a mess very, very quickly.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time. Mr. William Jones from Washington, D.C., and also Mr. Jim Kavanaugh from New York. Gentlemen, thank you for your time. Yemen's Ansarullah leader says Iran's retaliatory attack on Israel has changed the long-standing equation of the regime's hit-and-run strategy.
The operation, when it comes to its importance, it is that it establish the equation of responding to the Israeli enemy at the time where the enemy and its partners were striving to establish the equation of invading or attacking in the Arab world and elsewhere. The Israeli enemy, for tens of years, got used to striking Arab countries of Muslims, and not to receive any retaliation. This happened. It happened in Iraq, it happened in Sudan, it happened in various Arab countries. The Israeli enemy would strike targets for tens of years, and no one would dare retaliate militarily. Most of the time, sometimes there would be a complaint to the UN or to the Security Council. So establishing the equation of a strong military response, this is something very important at the time where the enemy wants to preserve the equation of being allowed to attack, whereby all of the Islamic Ummah, all the countries in the Arab world and elsewhere would be open for attack for the Israeli enemy, whereby they could do anything they want without receiving any retaliation. Also establishing the rules of engagement. If they attack, there will be a strong response and a decisive response, and their aggression will not go unanswered. This is something very important.
Addressing the Yemeni people in a televised speech, Abdel Malik al-Houthi hailed the Iranian response to the Israeli attack on his embassy in Damascus. He said Israel and its Western allies tried to downplay the significance of the operation after failing to prevent Iran's response. Al-Houthi, without naming a specific country, condemned some Arab states for protecting Israel during Iran's operation. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Yemeni leader said his country will continue its operations in the Red and the Arabian Seas until a total ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Shortly before midnight on Sunday, 14th of April, the Islamic Republic of Iran launched a swarm of drones and missiles at the occupied Palestinian territories in response to the Zionist regime's cowardly airstrike on Iran's consulate building in Damascus, Syria, on 1st of April. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Iran's retaliation against the Israeli attack on its consulate building in Damascus, Syria was not totally unexpected. However, the meticulous planning and massive scale of the attack marked a watershed moment and the beginning of the end of the occupying Israeli regime. A powerful message was delivered through a barrage of missiles and drones fired at midnight from different Iranian cities, which sent shockwaves in the power corridors of Tel Aviv. The Iranian armed forces first launched the Shahed-131 and the Shahed-136 type drones, widely filmed as they flew over Iraq. These drones needed about 6 hours to reach their target. About 4 hours after the Shahed-131 and Shahed-136 drones were fired, Iran's Parveh land attack cruise missiles were also launched for simultaneous landing in the occupied Palestinian lands. Both types of weapons represent the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps Aerospace Forces' lowest-cost, long-range strike assets. Their task in this operation was to force the enemy to spend its resources on them, committing its air power and spending significant more expensive air-to-air missiles to intercept them. Here, the higher speed of cruise missiles and their unknown quantity forced Israeli, British, Jordanian, and potentially French fighter jets to use air-to-air missiles instead of guns to save time. The cost ratio between the assets that Iran committed to the operation and the Israeli regime required to counter it was massive. Israel's fear of its GPS jamming not working against drones and cruise missiles led to the costly decision of intercepting them kinetically. 5 to 10 minutes before the surviving drones and cruise missiles were to reach their intended targets in the occupied Palestinian territories, Iran launched the main weapons of the True Promise operation. The ballistic missiles were not launched simultaneously on purpose to reduce the shock effect on Israel's missile defenses. Surviving drones and cruise missiles put additional stress on the radars and sensors, creating completely different targets at lower altitudes. These involved ballistic missiles Emad, Qadr, Desful, and Khaybar Shekan. The quantity of the launch missiles remains unknown and could range between 60 and 120. Descending from space like meteors, Qadr and Emad ballistic missiles would have first faced Israel's Arrow 3 missile interceptors, as well as the US SM-3. Those older Iranian missiles mainly defend themselves with inflatable decoys in space. The expensive and advanced American ANTPY-2 could have helped Israel's missile defenders to identify which objects were warheads, which empty spent boosters, and which were decoys. The 20-year-old Qadr missile may have created confusion for the radars, as well as guaranteeing their survivability by releasing submunition payload while still in space. In the chaos of ballistic missiles' re-entry vehicle housing the warhead, spent booster stages and submunitions released by Qadr and Emad missiles would also have released their decoys to survive against Arrow 3 and SM-3. Once Emad missile's re-entry vehicle enters the atmosphere, they can start to maneuver and alter their trajectory. This is done to increase precision and to perform random evasive maneuvering. Since Israel can't launch an interceptor for each of the several submunitions of Qadr, those inaccurate warheads are immune to the interceptors. However, Emad would rely on a short atmospheric flight time enabled by a steep dive trajectory plus random evasive maneuvering. Arrow 2, Patriot, and David Sling are the systems that tried to intercept and maneuvering Emad's re-entry vehicles. Emad missiles were also fast and glowing objects descending and impacting at 6 to 7 times the speed of sound. The slow glowing objects seem to be the submunitions of Qadr, and the slow objects in flame were likely to be separated empty booster stages. Another missile, Desful, was apparently launched against Israeli targets in the occupied Golan Heights. The Desful missile is limited to the northeast part of the occupied Palestinian territories by its maximum range, and can exploit the distance to Israeli missile defense barriers to perform its mission at Israel's periphery. No information about those strikes is available, but the low-cost Desful missile would avoid coming within Arrow 3 range by flying a relatively low trajectory. To counter endo-atmospheric interceptors like Arrow 2, Patriot, and David Sling's Stunner, it would randomly maneuver similar to Emad missile. The most advanced ballistic missile known to have been used in the operation is the Khaybar Shekan. This missile completely avoids Arrow 3 and SM-3 interceptors by flying inside the very upper layers of the atmosphere. Once close to the Arrow 2, Patriot, and David Sling, it further descends to engage with the Earth's atmosphere to begin random evasive maneuvering by its fins. Khaybar Shikan performs this manoeuvring in the upper atmosphere layers, and once it has slowed down to a certain threshold speed, it dives down at a steep angle. Since it depends on the selected trajectory, its impact speed can be 5 times the speed of sound, combined with prior manoeuvring. Some classify it as Iran's first hypersonic missile. Khaybar Shikan and Ahmad are candidates for some of the very clear impacts, foremost at least 5 successive hits seen in one of the videos. Other missiles that might have participated are the Rezwan and the Haj Qasem, but no clear launch or spent booster footage of those has appeared as of now. The targets were Israeli air bases, which represent difficult, highly protected, high-value assets of the Israeli regime. This target would not be a completely disproportionate response, achieve the retaliation objective, and display Iran's missile capabilities to Israel for strategic reasons. Website Axios has also covered the same story and tells us more. Israel in the past often responded disproportionately against others due to its military might. Its ballistic missile defense protected its critical military sites against ballistic missiles, and its air force and defense systems like the Iron Dome countered air-breathing threats like bomber aircraft. In that sense, it felt a high level of safety against any external attack, attracting multi-billion dollar investments for technology giants like Intel. Israel's overmatch in capability allowed for such fragile industries to come to the conflict region. The inability to protect a critical high-value object, like the Nevatim airbase, means Iran has the capability to repeat such a salvo against any object in the occupied Palestinian territories. Iran already displayed the accuracy and destructive power of its ballistic missiles in the salvo against the Ain al-Assad airbase, a US military base in Iraq, which was a soft target. Hence, independent of the damage caused, which had to be limited to resemble a proportional response in some way, Iran displayed the capability very clearly and strongly. From the limited information available on the targets that were hit in the occupied Palestinian territories, we see that taxiway sections and aprons were hit in a systematic manner. This is what someone would do if it doesn't want to cause heavy financial damage and keep the response near proportional. There is still only limited information about what was hit at the Nevatim airbase or even the Ramon airbase in the occupied Golan Heights amid a complete information blackout imposed by the Israeli regime. Another key aspect of the operation was the effort Iran forced upon the regime involving aircraft and its operation costs to counter drones and cruise missiles with air-to-air missiles. Only Israel clearly knows how many interceptors were spent in the observed ripple launchers. Only Israel knows about the reserves it has of these several times more expensive counters to the threat. Only Israel knows how well each of the systems, the Arrow 3 and the Arrow 2, the Patriot and David Sling, performed and which regions they cover at what quality.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, slowly but surely, you're gonna get there. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we are talking about slowly but surely you're going to get there. as a part of your Islamic lifestyle. So, of course, you know, we've got these interesting titles on A to Z every now and then, humbly at your service, trying to make this as interesting and fun as possible. So what are we talking about when we're saying slowly but surely you are going to be able to achieve a certain thing when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle? Well, that's pretty much it. It is this idea that overnight one cannot become this super Islamic lifestyle individual, right? It takes time, it takes practice, it takes effort, it takes determination, and it is a slow process, but it is slow and steady. So, for example, you know, sometimes we kind of get all excited and we're going to read 50 pages of the Holy Quran every single day, and the first day you do it, and the second day you do it, and the third day, you know, you start to think, well, it's 50 pages, and the fourth day, you kind of cut down to 25, and by the time the second week comes around, you just don't even want to look at the Holy Quran anymore. See, this is the opposite of slow and steady. So it's like, for example, all of these things are different kind of medications. The daily prayers, the Holy Quran, the recommended mustahabbat, you know, all of these things are these, I guess, their medicine, their cure, their healing powers. And if you overdose on these things, well, then there you go. You have overdosed on these things. And so the slow and steady, it's funny. That's the parable about the rabbit and the turtle, right? The turtle was slow and steady, and he ended up winning the race. And the rabbit was, you know, quick and fast, but, you know, he eventually lost the race. And so the slow and steady, meaning that we do something when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle in a manner where we do it continuously. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about slow and steady when it comes to trying to achieve something in our Islamic lifestyle. So now, slow doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, you're just incredibly slow. I'm only going to read a one rakat, one unit salah on this day because I'm going slow and steady. No, you know, we should be honest with ourselves. We should be honest with the Almighty Allah, who He is looking at us, He is hearing us, He knows what we are thinking, He knows what our intention is, right? He knows why we are doing something. So, you know, we might be able to deceive ourselves, even though that is quite difficult as well, you know, but we can definitely not deceive the Almighty Allah. And it is Allah, you know, at the end of the day, who is going to either reward us or punish us for those things that we did for the sake of Allah, or for those things that we did against the commandments of Allah. So, you know, slow and steady means that, okay, I'm going to make sure, and, you know, and it, you have to sit down and make a program. And I mean, you know, sometimes you need help with this, and I wish I could help every single one of you, you know, but you need help so that, for example, it varies in cases. An individual who doesn't pray any prayers of the five daily prayers, you need to pick one and start praying those continuously, and then move on to two, then move on to three, move on to four, but, you know, do it continuously. And whatever you do, this is the formula, is to do it steady, do it continuously, and keep on doing it until it becomes a natural part of your Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Iranian missiles were able to evade the much-vaunted $1 billion Iron Dome anti-missile system. The drone and missile strikes were preceded by a cyber attack on the Zionist regime's electrical grid, shutting down power, thereby disabling its radar system. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International Roads, Islamic Republic of Iran's widely anticipated retaliatory strike against the Zionist regime was carried out on Saturday, April 13th, codenamed Operation True Promise. Hundreds of drones and missiles were fired at the Zionist entity. What was even more striking was that all drones and missiles were launched from Iran's own territory, the first time that such an attack has been carried out against the Zionist regime's targets. Iran had vowed to avenge the Zionist regime's attack on its diplomatic mission in Damascus. Seven Revolutionary Guard members, among them Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, a senior commander of the IRGC's Quds Force, and his deputy, General Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi, were murdered. The April 1st Israeli regime strike was a clear violation of the Vienna Convention, under which diplomatic missions are fully protected. The fabricated regime of Israel has ratified the Vienna Convention. Thus, the Zionist regime's attack on Iran's diplomatic mission was an attack on Iranian territory. Iran's retaliatory strike was also in accord with Article 51 of the UN Charter that states that any state party against whom aggression is committed has the right to retaliate in self-defense. This is what Iran did against the Zionist regime. There are conflicting reports about the number of drones and missiles Iran launched against Israel. Iranian sources have reported between 400 to 500 drones and missiles launched against the Zionist entity. The Israeli sources say that there were about 350 drones and missiles fired at its territory, but that 99% of the threats against Israel were intercepted, according to Israeli Army spokesman Daniel Hagari. He conceded, however, that minor damage had occurred at the Nevatim Air Base in Beersheba, southern Israel. He added, 25 out of 30 cruise missiles were intercepted, and of the more than 120 ballistic missiles, only a few of them penetrated Israeli territory and landed at the Nevatim air base. Scott Ritter, a U.S. military expert and former U.N. weapons inspector, said on X, formerly Twitter, that at least 7 missiles had hit the Nevatim air base. Now, none was intercepted. What this means is that Iranian missiles were able to evade the much-vaunted $1 billion Iron Dome anti-missile system. The drone and missile strikes were preceded by a cyber attack on the Zionist regime's electrical grid, shutting down power, thereby disabling its radar system. Israeli regime military officials urged people not to show footage of Iranian missiles hitting targets. Some social media users have dismissed these requests and uploaded video footage of the damage caused to Nevatim Air Base, where the U.S.-supplied F-35 are stationed. It was from this base that the Zionist regime had launched its attack on the Iranian consular section at its embassy in Damascus. Israel has not taken any journalists, not even Israeli or pro-Israeli Western reporters, to verify its claims that the Nevatim Air Base suffered only minor damage. Beyond physical damage, two other factors are important. First, the psychological damage to Israelis as a result of this strike is enormous. Recently, millions of Israelis were cowering in bunkers amid air raid sirens. The financial cost to the Zionist regime is also enormous, estimated at over $1.35 billion. Second, and much more significantly, Iran was able to gather specific information about the location of Israeli defenses and their vulnerabilities. Iran will now be able to use this information for future operations. While the Israeli cabinet is weighing the options of attacking Iran, in his conversation with the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, U.S. President Joe Biden made clear that if Israel carried out an attack against Iran, Washington would not be there to help. Instead, Biden announced that he would call a meeting of the G7 to consider a diplomatic response to Iran's retaliatory strikes against the Zionist regime. It must be borne in mind that American, British, and French air forces intercepted a number of drones before they hit targets in Israel. Jordanian territory was also used to launch anti-aircraft missiles. The artificial kingdom is a U.S. Zionist puppet. It will pay a heavy price for such treachery. The cowardly Arab rulers have also been put on notice. If they allow their airspace to Israel or allow their bases for the U.S. to attack Iran, there will be a price to pay. Regional dynamics have been radically altered.
Deterrence.
Part 1.
In the early hours of the morning of Wednesday, the 8th of January, 2020, 13 Iranian missiles destroyed the Ain al-Assad U.S. military base in Iraq. Before the attack, U.S. President Trump had warned that if Iran attacks U.S. interests, Washington will target 52 sites in the country. And people across the world have for long wondered why the U.S. did not respond to Iran's missile attack. The outbreak of war between governments had never been as easy and accessible as in World War II. In this conflict, warring countries, big and small, came under attack, and the military industry had become so advanced that nothing, including huge numbers of manpower, the size of countries, and even unimaginable geographical distances, could prevent fierce enemy attacks. Between 1939 and 1945, the war, which involved more than 30 countries from different continents, had killed over 60 million people and caused huge and irreversible amounts of damage in all the countries involved. The catastrophe caused by the Second World War was so great that all governments began to think of ways to prevent such an event from happening again. Among the solutions was the establishment of the United Nations and other global alliances. But superpowers were looking for ways to come up with more effective deterrent measures. Two years after the outbreak of the conflict, the U.S. officially entered the war in 1941 when it was directly attacked by Japanese forces in Pearl Harbor. With the success of the Manhattan Project, which had led to the development of an atomic bomb by the U.S., in 1945, American forces attacked two of Japan's major cities. The nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki marked the end of the war, but the atomic bomb had a far greater impact. The catastrophes in Hiroshima and Nagasaki effectively provided security for the U.S. because it carried the message that any attack would lead to a nuclear response. The deterrence of military and nuclear power was so great that the role of organizations such as the UN was overshadowed and faded away. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union, with the help of German scientists, also developed nuclear bombs so that they could match the dominance of the US, and thus began a new era in human history. The arms race between the two superpowers of the world was the beginning of the Cold War era. During this time, neither the US nor the Soviet Union had an appetite for war, even though the two sides were fiercely hostile towards one another. Instead, they focused on strengthening their military, increasing their arsenal of weapons, and stockpiling nuclear warheads. During this period, weaker countries were forced to side with one of the superpowers in order to avoid overt and covert attacks. The Eastern and Western blocs emerged, and due to the close relations the Pahlavi royal court had with the US, it became a member of the Western bloc.
We particularly welcome you and the Empress as good friends and old friends.
The Pahlavi dynasty was so subservient to the U.S. that Washington honored the regime by naming it the Gendarme of the Region. But with the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people and the overthrow of the imperial regime, a new system of governance emerged in Iran, which had chanted neither west nor east from the beginning. The bipolar world now faced a new phenomenon called the Islamic Republic. The new system did not intend to follow the bipolar structure of the world and claimed to present a new discourse. A discourse opposed to superiority and arrogance, which made no distinction between the East and the West. It was unacceptable to the U.S. to lose one of the countries it had under its control, and so, from the very beginning, Washington showed its hostility towards the Islamic Republic in different ways. One of the first steps the U.S. took was imposing an arms embargo on Iran to weaken its military strength. Following the sanctions and less than 2 years after the revolution, Iraq's president Saddam Hussein, who had long dreamt of gaining control of the Persian Gulf, launches a full-scale attack on Iran, hoping to invade the country, which was deprived of military weapons, in a one-week period. Even though Iran does not possess much deterrent power militarily, the leader of the revolution calls on the masses to mobilize and help the country's limited military force. Iraq's mechanized infantry, which is not expecting to encounter the mobilization of the masses, is grounded and loses the initiative it had gained after a few days. As the war drags on, Iranian forces succeed in shifting the balance of power in their favor and push back the Ba'athist forces. Saddam, who had dreamt of invading Iran in a week, is now caught up in a long war of attrition. The consecutive victories of the Iranian forces on the battlefields lead Saddam to resort to another kind of military strategy. From the early days of the war, he had shown that he did not shy away from bombing residential border cities. In 1984, he began a campaign of heavy air raids, missile attacks, and artillery shelling on major cities and urban areas in Iran, which effectively began the War of the Cities. Despite harsh sanctions imposed by arrogant powers, Iran's diplomatic efforts pay off and Tehran is able to buy a number of missiles from Libya. Iran's first missiles are launched by a team from Libya. These initial strikes prove the deterrent power of missiles. After a while, under pressure from Iran's enemies, Libya refuses to launch any more attacks, and a small Iranian team decides to take matters into its own hand. When war broke out, Iranian forces realized their limited defense and military resources. Therefore, efforts were made to use the local knowledge of revolutionary forces in universities and other scientific centers in preparing and producing the equipment needed for war. Work on rockets was among the initial projects, and with the arrival of missiles, reverse engineering was also put on the agenda. The reverse engineering of high-tech missiles required a certain audacity which Iranians possessed. After Libya, Iran purchased a limited number of missiles from North Korea. Iran's missile units fire 88 missiles at designated targets in Iraq during the 6 series of raids in the War of the Cities. The war comes to an end, and Iran walks away with a commendable record and valuable experiences, despite all its limitations. Iranian engineering and production forces also succeed in achieving other magnificent results, such as the production of the Nazeat rocket, which was used toward the end of the war. For those who knew Saddam was a puppet of the U.S., it was obvious that the end of the war and Iraq's defeat would not prevent the U.S. from looking into alternative options to bring Iran to its knees. During the war, the U.S. had its military fleet present in the main waterway junctions in the Persian Gulf with the excuse of providing energy security. In 1990, with the occupation of Kuwait by Iraq, the Americans found a new excuse and increased their forces and military fleet to retake Kuwait. After the expulsion of the Iraqis from Kuwait, the U.S. forces maintained their presence in the Persian Gulf. Despite Iran's victory in the Iraqi-imposed war, the country had suffered irreparable damage. But at the same time, the war initiated the establishment of Iran's defensive infrastructures. These infrastructures played a key role in strengthening Iran's defensive approach. Research and studies began in the production of defensive weaponry in different fields, but the most significant focus was placed on activities in the missile sector. The round-the-clock efforts of forces who were constantly trying to achieve specific goals reduced complexities with the systematic management of commanders and the all-out support of the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Britain is facing food shortages and price rises because of various extreme weather events. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The United Kingdom faces food shortages and price rises as extreme weather linked to climate breakdown causes low yields on farms locally and abroad. Record rainfall has meant farmers in many parts of the United Kingdom have been unable to plant crops such as potatoes, wheat and vegetables during the key spring season. Crops that have been planted are of poor quality, with some rotting in the ground. The persistent wet weather has also meant a high mortality rate for lambs on Britain's hills, while some dairy cows have been unable to be turned out onto grass, meaning they will produce less milk. Agricultural groups have said The United Kingdom will be more reliant on imports, but similarly, wet conditions in European countries such as France and Germany, as well as drought in Morocco, have meant there is less food to import.